The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Richard Martin here with your edition of the Wake Up Call coming to you from Singapore through the good offices of PRN in New York City. Well, the date is Monday the 13th of September, and we've got a lot to talk about today, so let's get right into it. The America that so many have taken for granted for so many decades is literally disintegrating right in front of our eyes. Most Americans are still operating under the delusion that the United States will always be the wealthiest nation, quote unquote, and that its economy will always produce large numbers of high-paying jobs, and that the U.S. will always have a very large middle class. But that, of course, is not what is happening. The very foundations of the U.S. economy are rotting away, and the country now finds itself spiraling down an economic collapse. Already, millions of Americans are slipping out of the middle class and into the devastating grip of poverty. Statistic after statistic proves that the middle class in the United States is shrinking month after month. And meanwhile, millions of Americans are starting to wake up to the realization of the existence of very serious problems, but they have no idea what is causing economic distress, and they are totally unaware that most politicians have absolutely no idea how to fix the economic disaster. On the mainstream news, the American people are treated to endless footage of leaders from both political parties proclaiming that the primary reason that the country is in the midst of such an economic mess is because of what the other political party has done. Republicans claim that we are experiencing all of this economic chaos because of the Democrats, and vice versa. But, you know, the reality is that this economic nightmare has taken literally decades to develop, and both Democrats and Republicans have contributed greatly to the disaster. Both parties have absolutely refused to stand up to the Federal Reserve and the horrific economic policies that they have been shoving down your throats for decades. Both parties have stood idly by as the U.S. trade deficit has absolutely exploded in size and the United States has become significantly poorer month after month after month. Both parties have refused to do anything as large numbers of factories and good-paying jobs leave the United States. Both parties have shoved the spending accelerator on the floor when they have been in power, and now America has the largest national debt in the history of the world. Both parties have done essentially nothing as the healthcare industry, which was once the envy of the world, has degenerated into a cesspool of corruption and greed and now seems designed to do little more than provide pharmaceutical companies and health insurance crooks with obscene profits. You know, what we've created is a system where the laws are set up so that the power elite and their big dominant corporations always win. Why do you think so many of America's largest corporations pay so little in taxes? Why do you think so many of them are showered with government subsidies, tax breaks, and bailouts? It's not about competition anymore. It's about rigging the game in your favor. The power elite and the giant corporations they control spend millions and millions on lobbying and campaign contributions, and they expect a big return on that investment. Let's take a look at one example. Many people think that Barack Obama and the Democrats are supposed to be anti-business, right? Well, then, why are some of Barack Obama's biggest donors the very same corporations that are receiving giant bailouts, making record profits and paying their employees billions in bonuses? Goldman Sachs was Barack Obama's second biggest donor. Microsoft was number four. Citigroup was number six. JP Morgan Chase was number seven. Time Warner was number eight. You're starting to get the picture? Every single year, the U.S. Congress passes law after law that makes it easier for corporations to dominate and makes it easier for the rich to get even richer. America's economy is not about competition anymore. It's about eliminating competition. And unfortunately for middle-class Americans, the giant predator corporations that now dominate your economy are realizing that they don't really need nearly as many American workers anymore. Instead, they are slowly but surely shipping your jobs off to the other side of the world where workers are willing to work for about a tenth as much. And yet Americans still run out to the big box stores and fill up their carts with a bunch of plastic junk made on the other side of the world by these giant corporations. Meanwhile, those giant corporations are taking the profits they make out of America's communities, and they're taking their jobs and shipping them overseas. In the final analysis, is it any wonder why the income inequality gap is growing? Without small businesses having a legitimate chance to compete and without good jobs for American workers, the middle class in America is going to continue to get chewed up and spat out. Just think of these things for a while and tell me if you don't come to the same conclusions I do. As of 2007, the top 1% of all Americans was taking home 24% of the national income. This is a level that had not been seen since the days of the Great Depression. Incomes have been growing in the United States, but those at the very top of the pyramid have been gobbling up almost all of the income growth. According to Harvard Magazine, 66% of the income growth between 2001 and 2007 went to the top 1% of all Americans. Even official government figures bear out the fact that the rich are getting richer. An analysis of income tax data by the Congressional Budget Office a few years ago found that the top 1% of American households own nearly twice as much of the corporation wealth as they did just 15 years ago. Most Americans have suffered during the last few years, but not the boys and girls down on Wall Street. New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli says that Wall Street bonuses for 2009 were 17%. When compared to 2008. As factories keep leaving the United States and jobs keep leaving the United States and the federal government keeps going into more debt along with the state governments and local governments, things keep getting worse. It doesn't take a genius to figure that out. The United States is continually getting poorer and it's continually going into more debt. And anyone out there, please explain how that is a formula for economic prosperity? Seriously, can anyone explain how that can work? It is an inexorable fact that as wealth continues to leave the United States, and as the U.S. gets even deeper into debt, more Americans are going to become poor. It really is that simple. Almost 45 million Americans were living in poverty in 2009. And even as the number of Americans living in poverty skyrockets, the number of millionaires just keeps growing. In fact, the number of millionaires in the United States rose a whopping 16% to 7.8 million during 2009. The amount of money some of these Wall Street hotshots are making is incredible. Back in 2005, the top 25 hedge fund managers earned a total of $9 billion. That would be bad enough, but even in these hard economic times, the rich just keep getting richer. 1 year after the recent financial collapse, the top 25 hedge fund managers earned a total of approximately $25 billion. That breaks down to an average of $1 billion each. The truth is that the United States has been experiencing uneven prosperity for quite some time, and things just seem to get worse with each passing year. Government anti-poverty programs are exploding in size in response to the recent economic difficulties. The number of Americans in the food stamp program rose to a new all-time record of 40.8 million in May. That number is up almost 50% since the beginning of the recession. The number of Americans who cannot afford even the basic necessities is absolutely staggering. A whopping 50 million Americans could not afford to buy enough food in order to stay healthy at some point over the last year. Compared to other industrialized nations, the United States is doing very poorly. And you know, the saddest part of this is what it's doing, all this, is to the children of America. According to one recent study, approximately 21% of all children in the United States are living below the poverty line in 2010. But the American people cannot provide for their families if they don't have jobs. And today, there are not nearly enough jobs for everyone. In 2010, it takes the average unemployed American worker over 8 months to find a job. Approximately 10 million Americans are currently receiving unemployment insurance, which is a number that is nearly four times higher than what it was back in 2007. One out of every seven mortgages in the United States was either delinquent or in foreclosure during the first quarter of 2010. The cost of every U.S. government anti-poverty program is absolutely soaring. Meanwhile, the U.S. government is running already a budget deficit approaching $1.5 trillion every year. The U.S. economic system is dying. You know, blaming the other political party is not a solution. Running around the country offering hope and change and giving people a vague sense that things will get better soon is not going to cut it either. The American people need very real economic solutions to the very real economic problems. But American politics is not designed, it seems, to address these needs. Unfortunately, the American people love to watch the politicians play politics. They love to watch the little ping-pong ball of blame go back and forth. They love to pick sides and cheer for their team. It's also agonizingly irrelevant, but it may well be that there is no real solution artificially imposable by the powers that be, and that only a complete reset of the system can do the job. That is, I fear, the case, as I'm sure you all know by now. Right now, millions of Americans are getting sucked into poverty each year, and I don't think that either of the political parties can do anything real to address the very real economic problems that are causing that to happen. But the true tragedy is that most Americans have become so dumbed down that they don't even understand what the real problems are. All most Americans seem to want to do these days is to watch a good show. So send in the clowns. There are certainly enough of them in Washington, D.C. to keep them entertained indefinitely. You know, the truth is that there is a permanent underclass now of Americans that cannot get jobs. The number of Americans receiving long-term unemployment benefits has increased over 60% in just the past year. The wealth of the United States is being held in fewer and fewer hands. One study found that as of 2007, the bottom 80% of American households held about 7% of the liquid financial assets. It's not a good time to be living in the bottom half in America. The size of the pie being divvied up among those at the low end of the wage scale is becoming really, really small. In fact, the bottom 40% of all income earners in the United States now collectively own less than 1% of the nation's wealth. Even those Americans that still do have decent jobs are seeing their wealth fade rapidly. For example, U.S. families have $6 trillion less in housing wealth than they did just 3 years ago. Home ownership used to be a sign that one had arrived in the middle class, but in 2010, an increasing number of Americans are finding out that they simply can't afford their homes anymore. One in every seven mortgages was either delinquent or in foreclosure during the first quarter of 2010. The reality is that incomes have just not kept up with housing costs. And this has put an incredible amount of pressure on the middle class. Just how much pressure? Well, only the top 5% of all U.S. households have earned enough additional income to match the rise in housing costs since 1975. The debt binge middle class Americans have been on over the past couple of decades has drained many of them completely dry, and now more Americans than ever have bad credit scores. Over 25% of Americans now have a credit score below 599, which means that they are a very bad credit risk. A rapidly rising number of Americans are actually choosing bankruptcy as a way out of their financial problems. Nationwide, bankruptcy filings rose 20% in the 12-month period ending this past June 30th. The middle-class manufacturing jobs that once defined so many American cities are rapidly disappearing. Despite the fact that the U.S. population has dramatically increased, less Americans are employed in manufacturing today than in 1950. These days, it seems like almost everyone is looking for a good job, but very few people are finding them. According to one recent survey, 28% of all U.S. households have at least one member that is looking for a full-time job. Even many of those Americans that still have decent jobs have been hit hard by this economic downturn. A recent Pew Research survey found that 55% of the U.S. labor force has experienced either unemployment, a pay decrease, a reduction in hours, or involuntary move to part-time work since the recession began. The number of jobs that are evaporating is absolutely stunning. According to one analysis, the United States has lost a total of 10.5 million jobs since 2007. So where are the jobs going? Again, it doesn't take a genius to figure it out. China's trade surplus, much of it with the United States, climbed 140% in June compared to a year earlier. The truth is that the globalism and free trade have put middle-class American workers in direct competition with the cheapest labor in the world. This is what middle-class American workers must now compete against. In China, a garment worker makes approximately 86 cents an hour, and in Cambodia, a garment worker makes approximately 22 cents an hour. Due to these difficult economic conditions, the middle class is being squeezed as never before. According to a poll taken in 2009, 61% of Americans, quote, always or usually live paycheck to paycheck, unquote. That was significantly up from 49% in 2008 and 43% in 2007. So what kind of future do young people have in front of them? Unfortunately, things don't look pretty. Many fresh undergraduates cannot even get a job that will allow them to be independent. One recent survey of last year's college graduates discovered that 80% moved right back home with their parents after graduation. That was up significantly from 63% in 2006. Bernanke keeps talking about bank lending and consumer confidence. But how can anyone look at the most indebted nation in the history of the world and say it's suffering from a lack of credit? And why on earth should consumer confidence miraculously pick up when those consumers are broke and out of work? Is he suggesting that we start handing out Vicodin? Should we legalize pot? Bernanke knows very well that the real problem with the economy is a lack of demand. As he says, fiscal impetus and the inventory cycle can drive recovery only temporarily. For a sustained recovery, growth in private final demand, notably consumer spending and business fixed investment, must ultimately take the lead. End of quote. Well, in the past, the bulk of this has come from the consumer, but look at the numbers. American families, according to the Federal Reserve itself, already owe $13.5 trillion. That's twice what they owed 10 years ago and four times what they owed 20 years ago. For all the talk of people repairing their balance sheets, that figure has fallen by a grand total of 2.7% from its all-time peak in 2008. Meanwhile, the unemployment figures are far worse than the government admits. And by the way, Bernanke himself has said as much. And I quote, the small decline in the unemployment rate is attributable more to reduced labor force participation than to job creation, end of quote. Think about that for a second. If your definition of unemployed doesn't include those who have ceased to participate in the labor force, what use is it? We can find the real numbers for ourselves. And the Labor Department's own data show that among adult men of prime working age, 25 to 54, just 81.2% have a job in any kind at the moment. The figure until the crisis was nearly 90%. Back in the 50s, it was around 95%. The Labor Department further admits that a further 7% of those men are stuck working part-time, a sharp increase from 2 years ago due to the financial crisis. Put the two together and you discover that 25% of men of prime working age in America, that's one in four today, lacks a full-time job. Nearly one in five lacks any job at all. This is unprecedented in American history. Millions of families are broke, up to their eyeballs in debt and unemployed. And they can't get credit because lenders are at last worrying about whether they can pay the money back. The problem in this situation is not with the lenders. In the circumstances, I'd be more worried if someone told me consumer confidence was booming. If the economy gets worse, will politicians be able to do anything about it? Don't bet on it, even if the political system were not broken. This is an election season. Ben Bernanke thinks he can help by standing ready to purchase long-term treasuries. No solution there, I'm afraid. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Martin. This is the wake-up call, and we are alive and ready to receive your calls at 888-874-4888. I would love to hear from you. I am always willing and hopefully able to try to answer your questions as best I can. But also, we are always interested in your live rants. So if you would like to call in, please, again, call 888-874-4888. And if you would like to write in to the email system. I have an email page open throughout the program, ready to receive your emails. And the email address to write to is rm@gfawd.com. And that is the email. If you write it in, it takes a few seconds to arrive. I see it, and then hopefully I shall deal with it during the show itself. So this is real-time business here, ladies and gentlemen. Get to it. Write your emails or call the number, and let's hear from you. Again, the email address is rm, that's for Richard Martin, at gfawd, which is Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, .com. One final time, rm@gfawd.com. And then please feel free to call me personally if you have a confidential economic or financial problem that you would like me to talk to you about. I'm very willing to talk to you, and all you have to do is call our Sarasota, Florida number. It will come straight through to me in Singapore, and the number is area code 941-441-1682. Again, 941-441-1682. Okay. Well, even though one in seven U.S. residents struggles to get enough food, the nation's supermarkets throw away tons of produce and other food products every single year. According to a study by the California Integrated Waste Management Board, 63% of the average supermarket's waste stream is food. This comes out to 3,000 pounds per store per year. The bulk of this food is not unsafe for consumption. It includes food that has become visually less appealing, like bananas that have started to get brown spots, or potatoes that have started to turn green. Perfectly unblemished, spoilt food that is thrown away merely to make room for a new shipment, and packaged food approaching its sell-by date. Food recovery groups seeking to get such food into the hands of the hungry note that even food past its sell-by date is still safe for human consumption. Even meat can be good for several months past this date if frozen. All the daily specials, cooked food like ham and ribs, were dumped each night, says former Safeway Deli employee John Wadzinski. Quote, I had to throw out 10-pound hams that weren't even touched. It was easily 50 pounds of food a night. Unquote. In an attempt to stop supermarkets from wasting food while people go hungry, the Bill Emerson Federal Good Samaritan Food Donation Act went into effect in 1996, protecting supermarkets from litigation should someone become sick from donated food. The only exceptions to the law are cases of gross negligence or deliberate malice. Numerous states have passed similar laws. Yet even though such laws have never been challenged, stores continue to cite fears of litigation and bad press as a reason for throwing away edible food rather than giving it to those who need it. Many go so far as to install trash compactors to keep people from pulling the edible produce out of their dumpsters. An employee of Ralph's in Long Beach, California said, "Today I threw out 20 bags of lettuce. The code date was for yesterday, but I would have purchased any one of those bags." End of quote. The U.S. poverty rate is the third worst among the developed nations tracked by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Approximately 50 million Americans could not afford to buy enough food to stay healthy at some point during the last year. I wonder who that ties in with the next piece of information I have for you, namely a group of retired military officials recently expressed concern that school lunches are a threat to national security. According to them, the food being fed to children at public schools is making them, quote, too fat to fight, leaving a potentially considerable gap in military recruitment. Well, when I lived in New York, we used to have a deli on either side of the entrance to our apartment building, and we had one very healthy-looking homeless person who stood outside the door at all hours. During the day and at the end of each day, the delis would bring their leftovers outside to him, and he would disappear for the night only to return like clockwork the following morning. We always did wonder where he lived, but let me tell you, he was the best-looking homeless person I ever saw. All right, well, little quote from the Automatic Earth that I thought was worthy of your attention, ladies and gentlemen. Facing a scary and uncertain financial future, Americans are watching their wallets. 41% are planning to cut back on their spending over the next 3 to 4 months, compared with 8% who plan to increase it. 35% say they will plan to cut back their online spending over the next 3 to 4 months, compared with 12% who plan to increase it. 79% say they are planning to spend less money for Christmas this year. 87% say they do not plan to make a big ticket purchase, such as a house or a car, in the next 3 to 4 months. 49% have already delayed making a big ticket purchase during the past few months. 26% of Americans don't expect their personal finances to recover fully from the downturn until after 2011. And just as many, 26%, think their personal finances won't ever fully recover. Now you tell me how a nation of people who feel that way will turn around an economy that's based to such an extent, that 70%, on their spending habits. It's just simply not going to happen, which is why a government made up of wiser, smarter, and less conflicted people would take and have taken completely different measures from the ones that you have in front of you now. That's a subject we'll have to leave until another time. And by the way, when I talk about government, I mean all of them. White House, Congress, Senate, whatever, Republicans as well as Democrats. They're one and the same side of the same coin, trying hard to look distinguishable for power and monetary-related purposes. Not an interesting distinction, not when you're out of a job and homeless or close to getting there. America's economy is the accumulative spending power of its people, and Americans are broke. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the whole story. All right, here we come, and it is time for our break, and I will be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is John Rappaport inviting you to my new radio show on the Progressive Radio Network, which will air every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm an investigative reporter. I've spent 20 years researching health and medical fraud, deep politics. I'll have lots of very knowledgeable guests on the show who have information to share with you so that you can live a more healthy and informed life. Join me every Wednesday on PRN. That's 7 p.m. Eastern Time, the John Rappaport Show. See you then.
Hi, this is Dr. Meir Eisenstein. Listen to me every Monday evening at 7 p.m. I'm going to explain to you how less medicine, less pharmaceuticals, less vaccines may actually make you healthier. I'll be live. It'll be a call-in every Monday night at 7 p.m. Please come and join me.
So join in on the conversation at 888-874-4888. Every Monday at 7 with Dr. Eisenstein.
This is Mitchell J. Raven to tell you that we have two new time slots every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Raven as together we create a better world.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Here's an interesting situation that was sent to me anonymously for obvious reasons. It might be interesting to open up a discussion. So maybe you'd like to listen to it and feel free to call in with your opinion. Let me give you the call-in number once again in case I forget. It's 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888. When my fiancé and I bought a house in St. Petersburg, Florida in 2003, my business was strong. We had sales of between $4 and $6 million, and we employed 22 people. We could easily afford our three-bedroom home. But in 2007, my business took a downturn. My company specializes in biohazardous waste removal. When a house is infected with nuisance wildlife, such as raccoons, possums, or bats, a trapping company gets rid of the pests and we clean up the disease they leave behind. It can be anything from tuberculosis to anthrax. We relied on wildlife trappers to recommend us, but during the downturn, people chose to save money and just live with raccoons in the attic. I had to make 9 people redundant, and we struggled on. But by 2008, we had started dipping below the point at which I could afford even to pay myself. I had 13 employees, a fiancé and her 2 young daughters, and I was feeling the pressure. I began to negotiate with the bank about my mortgage, and eventually a man at the end of the phone advised me to default on my repayments. That way, he said, my case would be handed over to a different department, and I could renegotiate. I was unsure about this, but I took the bank at their word. I stopped the next month's payment and saved $1,800. I decided to use any spare money I had to advertise my business. It takes 4 or 5 months to be deemed officially in default, so I continued not paying my mortgage and using my spare cash to fund the advertising. Business was picking up. We waited for a letter to say that our mortgage had been transferred to the loan modification department and that we could begin negotiating, but instead we got a letter saying that our house was to be repossessed. I called the bank and pointed out that their advice had been to stop paying. But it turned out that our mortgage had been sold on, and the new company didn't want to negotiate the terms. I called my lawyer, and in one of those strange twists of fate, he had just come from a conference about foreclosure. "I think I can help," he said. But instead of the chance of renegotiation, we got another foreclosure notice from another mortgage company. I was confused. Our mortgage had been sold on so many times we didn't even know who owned it or who to call to discuss it. My lawyer advised me to pay nothing more. He asked the companies threatening me with foreclosure to provide my original mortgage document. None of them had it, so legally none of them could repossess my house as they couldn't prove they owned my loan. So I continued not paying and put spare money into my business, and 7 months later I was making a profit again. 2.5 years on, and I still haven't made a mortgage payment. My business is stable, I'm still living in my house, and I'm even looking at starting new businesses. People have criticized us, and we've been called deadbeats who aren't paying our bills. We've been accused of spending the cash we've saved on my gas-guzzling boat and expensive dinners. But I disagree with my critics. Large companies make strategic defaults on their loans so they can move the money into a better position to make more money. Why can't I? Of course, ultimately, we may end up losing our home, but at least my business is now stable enough that I could buy a new place if I needed to. If I had put my house first, my business would have gone under, and then all of us would have been out on the street. I took a risk, and it paid off. I've saved my business, the jobs of my 13 employees, and I still live in my home. Well, anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I think that's an interesting conundrum, and I would be very satisfied and gratified if you should feel the urge upon you to call up and discuss that very interesting concept. So I'm here and look forward to it. And in the meantime, I think we should take... Well, Steve just came in this moment with an email, Steve Kruger, that would be, saying, "Richard, you know hard times are upon us when you can find articles in the newspapers dealing with dumpster dining." I like that one. "Also, what is called savings rate is not really money saved. It's money used to pay down debt. It's money that vanishes. It's good to pay down debt, but it's not real savings." Steve Kruger. That is a very good point, Steve, and one that I've actually never made. I've always meant to make it, and I keep forgetting to make it. Ladies and gentlemen, when you see that the savings rate is up at 6.5%, which is where it is approximately right now, do not think that people have got 6.5% of whatever it is we're talking about in terms of a benchmark sitting in the bank wondering what to do with. Absolutely not. They're just in the process of what we call deleveraging, and this is going to go on for years and years to come. And be advised that all is not well just because savings are taking place. Of course, it's the usual, misnomer, the lying and prevarication of government statistics, the stuff we should have been all got used to by now, but I fear they're going to continue ad infinitum. Steve came in, Steve Canero, with an email just a few seconds ago. He says, "Hi, Richard. If enough people choose not to buy plastic junk from big box stores, does that lead to a kind of isolationism?" Depending on where people do go to get their nourishment, Steve, I suppose. If people grow their own food, yes, it definitely does. And all to the better, I suppose. But if people simply go to the corner shop and buy their provisions there, then clearly they're simply making alternative plans for their livelihood, and probably all to the better. But this question of food is one which I'm getting more interested in as time goes by. I don't think we're going to see food shortages, but I do think that we're going to see serious disruptions in the market, and I do think that people should be aware that there may be times when they find it hard to get certain products from the shelves. But I don't think we're looking at wholesale shortages of food. I don't think that that's going to happen. I know that some people do. Some people talk about stocking up with food in their homes. If I ever did think that that was a viable possibility, then I would let you know, of course. But I actually don't believe that will happen. The vested interests of people both who eat and who provide are simply too great for that to happen. The greed factor is really there. You've only got to look at a store like Walmart, which has been, you know, cutting ferociously for the last 2 years that I can make out, to see that stores will do whatever it takes to get the food down your throats, ladies and gentlemen. I think that process will continue unabated. Well, here's one for the history books, and I quote from the Commerce Department's figures. Inventories at wholesalers rose in July by the most in 2 years as a rebound in demand prompted companies to add to stockpiles. The 1.3% increase in the value of inventories was three times the median estimate in a Bloomberg News survey and followed a 0.3% gain the prior month. Commerce Department figures show today in Washington. Sales at distributors climbed 0.6%, the most in since April, after falling 0.5%. Ladies and gentlemen, what do you think the media did with that news? Can you imagine the whoopees and shouts of joy emanating from newsrooms all over the country? The excitable editors getting on their phones to their commentators, "Hey Joe, get a load of this one, milk it for all you've got." For example, here's one from Bloomberg, which states, and I quote, "The amount of goods on hand compared with sales suggests manufacturing gains will be sustained in coming months," end of quote. Well, ladies and gentlemen, how does that jive with the Wells Fargo Gallup Small Business Index, which measures small business owners' perceptions of six measures of their current operating environment and future expectations, which fell 17 points to minus 28 in July? This is its lowest level since the index inception in August 2003. A record low, ladies and gentlemen, and please remember that small business owners are the embodiment of America's entrepreneurial and optimistic spirit, and their increasing concerns about their company's future operating environment do not bode well for the economy in the months ahead. Nor do small business owners' intentions to reduce capital spending and hiring. 17% of owners plan to increase capital spending in the next 12 months. Well, I tell you, when you let listeners know about such things on CNBC as an invited guest, very simply, they do not invite you back. Okay, well, now here's a statistic that you never should lose sight of, ladies and gentlemen, because it really tells the story of how bad things are. Um, Well, let me just take Nick's email before we go into this. I just got an email from somebody called Nick who says, "Hi, Richard. I would like to know what you think are the main challenges bound to hit gas station and convenience store businesses in this economic climate. I know this is an overly general question, but I wonder if you have any info on what lies ahead for convenience stores and retail establishments in general and some ideas on how to stay competitive. Thanks always for your illuminating perspectives on matters economic and otherwise. Nick." Interesting question, Nick. I just read just a few minutes ago before coming on the air that there is a brand new set of stores coming into Broward County, Florida, to then enter into Miami-Dade County. I've forgotten their names, but they are stores which are simply designed to provide nothing more than brand name, or rather store name products to consumers. In other words, everything else will be eliminated from the stores. So only the barest essentials will be made available in large quantities, and they are expecting to reduce prices by about 25% to 30%. It's an experimental concept in Broward, obviously predicated on the awful economic environment that we're living through right now. But I do think that it might work. And the sort of oblique answer to your question is that I think that since things are going to get worse, Nick, convenience stores will have it hard because they do have much greater markups for obvious reasons, and I think that people will be less inclined to spend money in there, and I think that a lot of them will hurt, a lot of them will in fact close down, and the cutthroat competition between the regular grocery stores will just simply grow. And the Walmarts and the Targets will definitely come out on top. I would think that there isn't much you can do to stay competitive under those circumstances. Depending on what kind of profit margins gas stations can derive from their basic product, I think you need to concentrate on that. I don't think that convenience store businesses are the way to go in the coming environment. I think after that period of time at some point, then there will be a case for strategically placed convenience stores to come together again. But in the short term, short medium term, I would not be optimistic about their future. All right, well, a full 70%, as I started to say, a full 70% of the American economy is based on consumer activity, as the point I have made more than once. For many years, analysts suggested that the consumer would hit the wall and that the U.S. would suffer slower or negative growth as a result. For years, if not decades, those analysts were wrong. Well, why were they wrong? They were wrong because they failed to understand how long credit creation could induce average people to live beyond their means. And so they did exactly that. The last major credit inducement that finally did cause American consumers to hit the wall was compliments of Alan Greenspan, who flooded the banking system with credit following the dot-com boom. And to avoid the pain of that bust, his enormous creation of money out of nothing resulted in the housing boom. And it was the housing boom that finally took the credit system and the ability of Americans to continue living beyond their means to the limit. Now, with that 70% of the economy flat broke, the U.S. economy is destined for very difficult times. And if history is any guide, the policies likely to be enacted, while perhaps bringing some very temporary relief for some people, will make the system all the worse. We're breaking down into a deflationary depression. I see continuing problems in the banking system that's going to put the banks at risk because bad debts on credit cards and mortgages and everything else are a lot more. They have still got those bad assets. with the kinds of deficits we're running, there is no way that the economy is sustainable. When you see Medicare is broke, Social Security, none of these things are sustainable, then they go out and get another benefit, a new health care plan. How crazy is that? So the country's borrowing 42 cents out of every dollar it spends that keeps going up. The whole thing is totally irrational, and we are completely running off the track with wild, wild government spending, irrational deficits. And quite frankly, the only difference between the U.S. and Greece is that America can borrow and they couldn't borrow anymore, which of course makes it worse for America. So I think we're in a terrible position. When you go across the country and talk to small business owners, they can't get credit. They just can't get credit. They can't possibly grow. They're not going to hire. They don't know what the new health care bill is. No one understands it. Lehman Brothers collapsed. Bear Stearns collapsed. So if you wonder what happened, well, they had 3 cents in capital for every dollar. That's what happened. So if you look at these companies and you say, well, what would have happened if they'd had 20 cents? No one would have gone broke. Everything would have been fine. Too big to fail was ridiculous. No one should have been bailed out. I pleaded with people to send messages to their Congress people at the time. And in fact, the first bailout bill was defeated, as you may remember. The bill sent a terrible message. America needed to get into the restructuring business. The United States must restructure its economy. Now, what works is pain. Unfortunately, only massive doses of pain. That is the only thing that works. You have to have pain. Then you shrink the size of government. Tremendous pain. Medicare can't be paid for. That's pain. Social Security is not able to be paid for. Every government institution is broke, including the FBI. So we've got to have tremendous amounts of pain to fix this problem. And we've avoided the pain. We've piled on the debt. We have exploded the debt. We've exploded the deficit. Look at what they've done with the municipalities. All broke. Illinois, New York, it's endless. California. What Obama did is bailed them out. So none of them has taken the appropriate actions, and now they're broke again. How is the U.S. going to keep the teachers? How are they going to keep these policemen? You know, America is in the restructuring business. All the roads, frankly, lead to hell. You don't keep enough for you. You have to make choices on where to cut. You have to make choices not to be bailed out. So everything that is being done is the wrong thing, putting things in the wrong place, putting the country more and more at risk, putting the dollar at risk. Just look at the performance of the dollar. I mean, everything is going in the wrong direction. Obama has been wrong on everything, and so has his administration. I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, I think it's just going to be catastrophic. You look at the housing picture. It's amazing. All you have to do is look at the amount of supply out there. I mean, to me, that's just bad. It's just hell on earth. Housing's going to collapse. It's going to collapse. And it'll collapse as if it were the very first time. You've got a situation in housing where we've got production of housing way down, home vacancies way up. That's the formula for debt. When you've got production of housing on the floor, which is what you've got, and you've got vacancies up, that means you're guaranteed a collapse. And that's exactly what you've got dead ahead. You've got home construction at the low. You've got vacancies at the high. And remember that housing's the consumer's largest asset. That's what they have used as a piggy bank and everything else to refinance on and on and on. But the formula of where we are in housing is indisputable. We're headed for an apocalypse in housing. It is coming, ladies and gentlemen. And again, that affects the banks. People seem to think that the banks are fixed, but absolutely nothing could be further from the truth. First of all, when you take the banks, what are all of these numbers they have? I can't figure out what these accountants are doing, and I can't even understand how the accountants could possibly be in business. They're being paid fees of $20 million and $30 million. They have hundreds of people working at these banks. They come in every 3 months. They value the assets. They're doing everything. What are they doing? What are they shaking? What numbers are they using? How do you evaluate a situation in which all the debt has been taken off the books of the too-big-to-fail banks? I don't understand the accounting standards they're using or anything else. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know how one can ever evaluate anything without the real numbers, and we just don't have real numbers. The main problem was all the leverage everywhere. But the reason they got the leverage is because all the numbers were fake. The whole thing was a gigantic Ponzi scheme. And, of course, the companies have every interest in getting their bonuses. I mean, we all understand what happened, on and on and on, but the accountants are supposed to be there to check every detail. They're signing off on the financial things quarterly. Ladies and gentlemen, no enclosed shopping centers or shopping malls are being built this year. Let me repeat, none. So if you are in the mall business, you have vacancies up and rents down, right? No question about that. That's just hard numbers. Enclosed shopping centers are not being built because department stores are not growing. It's one of the weakest parts of the retail business. By the way, Central Properties also collapsed, and that's a huge shopping center developer. So you've got a bad situation in commercial real estate generally, and you have it now in office and other things, and we all know that, and that's a crisis that's also going to smash the banks that are going to hit those community banks very hard. Now, remember that the banks were told by the FASB that they didn't have to declare their real valuations. They could hold on to their fantasy valuations until or unless they came to sell properties. And of course they're going to sell the properties, and that will push many more banks into direct bankruptcy in short order. And you know, with the retail environment staying tough, and it will stay tough, you're going to have an ongoing problem in closing shopping centers and restructuring that and all the rest of it. There's 21 square feet of selling space for every man, woman, and child in America, which probably needs somewhere between 12 and 14 square feet. And with the growth of the Internet, it's going to need even less. That's a problem, ladies and gentlemen. And it weighs on the whole concept of how many stores get built. And because of easy money, stores were just built everywhere. None of it made any sense. And everybody got a free lunch, you know? The country is in terrible shape. It's getting worse every day. I mean, every day, when you look at this healthcare plan, look at the financial regulations, and of course the massive fraud in the banking business, and the shadow banking business, and even bigger disaster with AIG, Lehman, and all the rest of them in the shadow, they are unregulated, they are completely unregulated. Of course we need control. Of course we need higher capital requirements. That's the key, and it has to be put in over time. You can't do it tomorrow because the whole economy will collapse, but you can at least start that tomorrow. They just wrote this 2,000-page bill, but you know what? It doesn't say anything in there about what the capital requirements should be for the financial regulations, and yet they've been working on this for years. So none of this makes any sense. Their approach to everything is highly and utterly illogical. We had a problem of over-leverage. That's the problem. And nothing has been done, incredibly, to stop the bleeding. We are just digging the hole deeper. The country is getting more and more in debt. I simply fail to understand what they're trying to do. They say they're going to insure 30 million more people. They've been treating people in Afghanistan for 9 years. I don't think living standards can ever possibly remain the same in this country. I think the people are starting to recognize that with debt, the unemployment forever, the structural deficits, everything else, that there's no easy way out of this, ladies and gentlemen. There is no way out of this problem. I simply do not know how to put this more succinctly. There is no way, absolutely no way, that you can avoid the apocalypse which is coming your way. And, you know, as we talk about this, and the poor get poorer and the rich get richer, the CEOs who laid off the most employees during the recession are also the CEOs who took home the biggest paychecks. According to a study released last week, CEOs of the 50 U.S. firms that slashed the most jobs between November 2008 and April 2010 took in 42% more than the average CEO at an S&P 500 firm. And that's according to the 17th annual Executive Excess Study by the Institute for Policy Studies, a progressive Washington think tank. The study also found that 36 of the 50 layoff leaders, quote, announced their massive layoffs at a time of positive earnings reports, end of quote, suggesting again a trend of, quote, squeezing workers to boost profits and maintain high CEO pay, end of quote. I'll keep you informed. That's the best I can do. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. I will be back on Friday with more of the same. This is Richard Martin wishing you a very good, wealthy, healthy, and prosperous weekend ahead. Thank you. Bye-bye.